coming up this Friday afternoon, the end of the lectureship. Been a good lectureship. My name is Dave Bland. Some of you may not know me, but I teach at Harding School of Theology in Memphis. I've taught there for 24 years now, and have preached in Oregon for 13 years at Portland before moving to Memphis, and also preached in Memphis for 16 years. So I have my feet in both academia and ministry. I hope that by this time of the lectureship, you have an OD on Ecclesiastes. Yesterday, both of the keynotes were related to Ecclesiastes, and of course, Chris Hurd, the last 2 days, has been speaking on Ecclesiastes and has done a really good job. I think several of you were here for him. If you weren't here for him, who wasn't here for him the last couple of days? Okay, well, several of you. All right. I'm not going to repeat a lot of things that he said, but I am wanting to springboard off of things that he has talked about. He did a really good job. And he had a meeting at this time with the dean that he could not cancel. But if you did not get, I hope he comes maybe a little later. He may not be able to, but he had a really good handout on what he called the Gatherer's Hashtag, and that would be worthwhile to get. It was a good summary of Ecclesiastes. There's good reason that this book is in the canon, obviously. Ecclesiastes really gives us a reality check on life. It puts our American optimism in perspective. We have a real escape mentality about a lot of the things that Ecclesiastes talks about. I think that there are there should be several times during the year that we should read through Ecclesiastes to keep life in perspective and to keep our arrogance from taking over. Ecclesiastes is a really important book to read in order to maintain our humility about who we are and about what we can accomplish and just about our life in general. What I want to do during this session is to, as you see on the outline there, I'm just going to follow that outline, but not in any, I'm going to skip over several things and try to focus on just some key elements since we just have a 45-minute session here. What I want to spend most of our time on is two texts in Ecclesiastes that I think are representative and that will really help orient us toward teaching and preaching this book, and that's what my focus is for this particular hour. So, you know, there are different ways of approaching Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes is one of those books where there are several different perspectives on it. There are those who would say that there is a particular scholar that would say that all sermons and all lessons that you teach on Ecclesiastes should include the mention of Christ, bring Christ into the book. And that's not bad. I do have some reservations about that. And I want to hear Ecclesiastes on its own terms. And it is part of our Christian scripture. And yes, Christ is has to be Ecclesiastes has to be looked through our Christian eyes. But I want to hear it on its own terms, and that's what I would advocate for the sermons that and the lessons that I would preach on it. Some would also say that Ecclesiastes is really, the purpose of it is to describe life at its worst and therefore prepare us for the gospel of Christ. That I have reservations about that as well. I think there is more to it than just simply looking at life as a gloom and doom and then no other way but to go to or drive us to faith in Christ. I think there's more to it than that, and I'm going to approach it from that angle. So some key issues and themes in Ecclesiastes. This is where I want to just kind of move through this and highlight just a few things here. And focus on just one thing in the facts of life for Ecclesiastes. Life is unpredictable. We've heard about that a lot this week. Justice is scarce. God is unknowable. Wisdom is elusive. Death is inevitable. That is a theme that is that Qohelet, Ecclesiastes, hammers on over and over again. And if you weren't here the last couple of sessions, the title of Ecclesiastes in Hebrew is Qohelet, which means assembly or one who assembles. Ecclesiastes is the Greek form of that. Ekklesia is maybe a more familiar word to us. But death is inevitable, and Qohelet just hammers away at that from beginning to end, enabling us or forcing us, maybe I should say, to face the reality of that in our life. Death is just pervasive in his book as he talks about all these different elements and aspects activities that he engages in. I had an uncle one time, his famous saying to me, or what I remember most about him, was he would say, life is hard and then you die. And Ecclesiastes may have some affinity with that kind of statement. And I think it's important to constantly be reminded, and not in a morbid kind of way, but in a way that really puts life in perspective, that death is, you know, is inevitable. That's where I believe this this little children's prayer would be good for adults to pray. Now I lay me down to sleep. I pray the Lord my soul to keep. If I should die before I wake, I pray the Lord my soul to take. I think that's a pretty good adult prayer to pray on a regular basis. Actually, we have grandchildren, and we don't pray that prayer that way. We change it a little bit. Later on, we might revert back to the original, but we pray, now I lay me down to sleep. I pray the Lord my soul to keep. May angels watch me through the night and guide me with the morning light. For a 4 and 5 year olds, we think that's a little more appropriate. But there's a time when the original one needs to be reinstated in our prayer life. But the whole point is that life is beyond human control. We are, as humans, given limits by God. The theological themes. I just want to focus on one. Briefly here, which really sets up the at least one of the texts that I want us to look at during this time. And I'm on letter B there, theological themes. Life is a gift. There are, and it depends. Chris Hurd, the last couple of days, I identified four of what he refers to as there is nothing better passages. There are four of those. But actually, there are, at least according to some counts, there are about seven of these passages that are sometimes referred to as carpe diem, seize the day passages. There are seven of them, and again, don't confuse them. And this is one of the points that he made, and I really appreciate it. You have to be careful about confusing the contemporary idea of carpe diem with Kohelet's understanding of carpe diem, seize the day. The contemporary perspective on carpe diem is really self-fulfilling, self-centered, self-fulfilling. Ecclesiastes, Kohelet's, is, in my view, an expression of faith. These are statements of faith. You don't have to wait till the very end of the book to get the conclusion. These are sprinkled all the way through the book, and I see them as Kohelet's summary of what he has discovered in, you know, in this life. Now, I think it was last night, was it, who was the speaker last night? I just forgot his name.
Dr. Holmes.
Holmes. I believe he mentioned this, or one of them mentioned this yesterday in the keynote, that Ecclesiastes, interestingly, is read during the Feast of Booths, or the Hebrew word is Sukkot. The Feast of Booths, Feast of Tabernacles, which is a seven-day feast, which is in the fall around harvest, and really the Feast of Booths serves two purposes. One, it celebrates the fall harvest, and two, it celebrates Israel coming out of being delivered out of Egypt. And at the Feast of Booths, there is, as you probably know, these little huts that they make, and they serve two purposes. Farmers during this time built huts in the field to keep wild animals away from the crops. But also, as you know, it is a commemoration of the temporary abodes, the temporary housing that Israel had in the wilderness. And so Ecclesiastes is read at that feast. Ecclesiastes, that appears to be a real gloom and doom book, is read at a very festive feast, a feast that celebrates harvest, that celebrates deliverance. I think that's a real important clue to how this book should, at least an important emphasis that should be placed on this book. I'd like for someone who has a Bible, if you would turn to Deuteronomy. Somebody turn to Deuteronomy 16 and read verses 13 through 15, if you would. Somebody, when you get that, Deuteronomy 16, verses 13 through 15. This describes, in brief, the Feast of Sukkot, the Feast of Booths.
Anyone? Celebrate the Festival of Tabernacles for 7 days after you have gathered the produce of your threshing floor and your winepress. Be joyful at your festival, you, your sons and daughters, your male and female servants, and the Levites, the foreigners, the fatherless, and the widows who live in your towns. For 7 days celebrate the festival of the Lord your God at the place the Lord will choose. For the Lord your God will bless you in all your harvest and in all the work of your hands, and your joy will be complete. 3 times a year, all your men must appear before the Lord your God at the place he will choose, at the Festival of the Unleavened Bread, Festival of the Weeks, and the Festival of Tabernacles. No one should appear before the Lord empty-handed.
Okay, thank you. Festival of Booths, in a lot of ways, would be similar to our Thanksgiving holiday. And can you imagine reading Ecclesiastes at Thanksgiving? Well, that's very similar to what the Israelites were doing with Ecclesiastes at their harvest festival, at the festival where they celebrated the harvest as well as celebrated their deliverance from Egypt. So I bring that up. It's already been mentioned, but I wanted to emphasize it again because for me, that serves as an important context out of which to teach and preach this book. Here is something that James Lindbergh says about this festival. Some of you may know him. He's an Old Testament scholar. Says, Sukkot is a celebration of the beauty of things that don't last. The little hut, the ripe fruit, the friends, the leaves changing. It comes to tell us that the world is full of good and beautiful things, food and wine, flowers and sunsets and autumn landscapes and good company to share them with, but that we have to enjoy them right away because they will not last. James Lindbergh in one of his books. So I'm going to use that context, that religious context, to me is a help in interpreting and understanding Ecclesiastes. Letter C there, characteristics of God. In Ecclesiastes, Kohelet sees God as distant. Remember what he says in 5:2? God is in heaven, you are on earth, so let your words be few. And in Ecclesiastes, nowhere is the covenant name for God used. Nowhere is the covenant name Yahweh, a personal name for Israel's God, is used. It's always, 40-some-odd times, Elohim, which is the more generic, general name for God. For Kohelet, God is sovereign, God is transcendent, and that is a very important quality for him. But as Chris has pointed out the last couple of days, God is central for Kohelet. God is not on the margin. God is really central in his life and for what he is investigating. But I would say this, and I'm going to get to this a little later, just trying to set things up right now. Even though God is distant, he doesn't remain that way. There is a way in Ecclesiastes that God presents himself in a very personal way, in an intimate way, a relational way, and we'll get to that in just a moment. But it's a different way of God presenting himself. The chief virtue of for Kohelet of God is the fear of God. That's the chief virtue. And it's found, that phrase, fear God, fear God, fear God, is found not just at the end, but also it is sprinkled through the book as well, several times. And then the word hevel, Chris has dealt with that a lot. I really like the way Chris talks about it. It is, for those of you who haven't been here, it basically means breath, vapor. It means something that is brief, something that like a vapor or a fog, something that is difficult to understand or comprehend. So this idea of brevity and incomprehensible is a part of that word hevel. And hevel is always directed toward human activity and not toward divine activity. I think that's important to keep in mind. All right. Two passages. Ecclesiastes chapter 2, verses 24 through 26 is the first one. And in order to really understand and appreciate this first, what sometimes been referred to as joy passage, or carpe diem passage, in order to really understand this first carpe diem passage, we need to kind of back up and set the stage for it as well. In chapter 2, let me say this. Hevel, vanity, breath, fog, vapor, that word appears 38 times in Ecclesiastes. Almost half of those appear in the first two chapters, which is really significant as we lead up to verses 24 through 26. Almost half. Chapter 2, as he sets out in chapter 2, I really like Chris's way of describing Kohelet. Kohelet as the one who assembles. He refers, Chris Hurd referred to, Kohelet likes to refer to him as the gatherer, one who gathers students for assembly, one who gathers proverbs or wisdom sayings, one who gathers, some facetiously say, one who gathers women, if you think of Solomon in the background. One who gathers, in chapter 2 here, one who gathers things, one who gathers material things. And so, I want to read here this, at least part of it. In verses 1 through 11, Kohelet is basically playing God for a day. And what he is trying to do is recreate the Garden of Eden. He is king, or at least in that persona of king. And he is wanting, and especially in verses 4 through 11, you see very similar language to what you have in Genesis 1 and 2. Very similar language. And so here Kohelet is trying to recreate the Garden of Eden and play God for a day. I said to myself, verse 1, come now, I will make a test of pleasure, enjoy yourself. But again, this also is vanity or hell, or a better translated breath or vapor. Instead of laughter, it is mad, and of pleasure, what use is it? I search with my mind how to cheer my body with wine. Now move down to verse 4. And from verses 4 through 8, verses 4 through 8, eight times this preposition for me is used. Now you can't see it in the English text, because in the English text, that is not good grammar. It's just not aesthetically pleasing. For me, for me, for me, for me. Okay, you get the point, so we'll just in English do it a few times. But eight times in the Hebrew text, this prepositional phrase, for me, is used. That's important, all right? Because guess where the focus is? I'll try to bring it out as I go along. I've kind of written it here in my English translation. I'm using the New RSV. Verse 4. I made great works. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks and planted in them all kinds of fruit trees, kind of reminiscent of the Garden of Eden. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. In fact, I already skipped one for myself. Never mind. I bought male and female slaves and had slaves who were born in my house. I also had great possessions of herd and flocks for myself, more than anyone who had been before me. Again, a form of the prepositional phrase for myself. Also gathered for myself silver and gold, treasures of kings and provinces. I got singers for me, both men and women, delights of the flesh, and made concubines. Here is a pursuit of, he's gathering. He's the assembler of all of these material things, stuff. To see if that really brings meaning to his life. And, of course, what he says at the end is, in verse 9, verse 9, so I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. My wisdom remained with me, another form of for myself. Whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. So, pleasure here. And then he concludes, verse 11, there was nothing to be gained. It was just vanity and chasing after the wind. Now, notice the contrast between Genesis 1 and 2, what God makes, and Ecclesiastes 2, what Kohelet makes or tries to make. What does God say after he had created the world, after each day?
It is good.
What does Kohelet say after he creates all this? It is useless. It's vain. It's vapor. It is chasing after the wind. Quite a contrast. Quite a contrast. We need to understand that contrast before we get now to the Carpe Diem, the joy passage. And keep in mind, this Carpe Diem is different. It's not self-fulfillment. Rather, it is a statement, in my view, a statement of faith. So I'm going to skip now to verse 24. There is nothing better for mortals than to eat and drink and find enjoyment in their toil. This also I saw. And when he uses the word saw here, I saw, it's more than just visual. It's an experience. Remember what the psalmist says? Oh, taste and see. Oh, taste and see that the Lord is good. In other words, there's more to it than just a kind of a visual content. He's experiencing this. This also I saw is from the hand of God. This is about, I say about, there is one reference in chapter 1 to God, but it's in a negative kind of connotation. This is basically the first reference to God. In all of Kohelet's pursuit, there is no mention of God. It's only here, in verses 24 through 26, that God comes into the picture. There is nothing better for mortals than to eat and drink and find enjoyment in their toil. This also, as I saw it is from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? For to the one who pleases him, God gives wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner, he gives the work of gathering. Notice that. You know, the assembler, the gatherer. So the one who doesn't have the gratitude toward God or acknowledge God, then he just turns him into a gatherer like he does in the first part of chapter 2, or most of chapter 2, actually. Just doesn't the work of gathering and heaping, only to give to one who pleases God. This also is vanity and a chasing after the wind. This also is vanity and chasing after the wind. In other words, my interpretation of that is that if you try to pursue enjoyment, it is like chasing after the wind. If you accept it as a gift, and I like the way that Chris Hurd put it yesterday, if you accept it as a present, dual meaning, present in the moment, present as a gift, in the moment as a gift. That's the only way that this would not be vanity or just foggy and chasing after the wind. A couple of things here before we move to the next passage. And that is, in verses 24 through 26, to me, as I preach through this, and I preach through a series on Ecclesiastes, I've worked to try to enable these joy passages to be a part of every sermon as I go through it. There are seven. I try to make them a part of that, so that you know you keep on coming back to that particular point. Now, that may create some problem. There might be too much repetition, but at least from my perspective, I didn't think that that was the case. You might want to talk with those who listen to those sermons. In verses 24 through 26, Kohelet is not describing the task of pursuing pleasure. He's not, in verses 24 through 26, he is not pursuing pleasure like he was earlier. But rather, he's not, compulsive or obsessive or about gaining enjoyment or pursuing it. Rather, he is simply receiving it, accepting it as a gift. And you notice in these verses that joy, there is joy in work, which is different than having joy as the result of work. In other words, work in and of itself, because it's from the hand of God, is a joy. And it's not just getting to the end product. That's an important element, at least to me, in this passage. So work is a vocation. It's a ministry, you might say. Paul says, in the Lord your labor is not in vain. That it's rewarding in and of itself as it worked out. So in this first joy passage, this first Carpe Diem passage, you don't chase down these things. You don't buy these things. You don't bargain for these things. You don't pursue these things. You simply accept them. You receive them from God. So this is a God-centered life. That's critical to understand. And so we seize this time, enjoy this moment, the good life that is life centered on God and not striving for self. For me, for me, for me, for me, as he repeats in the first part of this. Now here's, I said that Koheleth, and he does, view God as sovereign and distant. God is in heaven, and you are on earth. And the sovereignty, there clearly is this distance. Koheleth acknowledges that. But as a person participates in receiving the gifts that God has given, these ordinary, these daily, oftentimes overlooked gifts, as we receive them, that brings us into contact with God. As we enjoy fellowship with friends, I mean, eating and drinking, I mean, you don't do that in private. At least in Scripture, that's not what you do in private. You always eat as a part of expressing communion and the community with others. When we eat and drink and enjoy friendship, we then enjoy God's presence. That's the way the distant God brings himself into contact with us. So that gulf between God and humans is bridged by God, who gives these everyday good gifts. So these are, you know the phrase, the mighty acts of God. God who, what? What are some one of the mighty acts of God in the Old Testament?
Creates.
God who creates. Who delivers from Egypt. Who enables them to cross the Red Sea. Who is with them in the wilderness. Those
makes
are the mighty acts.
Pardon? Makes covenant, keeps covenant.
Makes covenant, keeps covenant. In Ecclesiastes, it's the minor acts of God that Koheleth emphasizes. These are the minor acts that God gives to us as gift, as present, as Chris has brought out. You know what the Shema is? The Shema. Hear, O Israel. Shema means hear. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one God. That's the Shema. For wisdom and for Ecclesiastes, the Shema is enjoy God's good gifts. That's the Shema for Koheleth. All right, I want to move on. Need to move on here. I don't know whether are you guys familiar with Thornton Wilder's play Our Town?
Yes. Yes.
That might be a good way to bring in or a connection, if you will, with this whole Carpe Diem perspective on life. Okay, chapter 11 is the other one. Chapter 7 through 11, there is this phrase, and I've highlighted in my Bible, and it just goes all the way through, the idea of who can find out, may not find out. And I've just looked through here, mortals may not find out. Who can find out? I'm just looking at chapter 7 right now. I have not found out. I have not found out again. Chapter 8, who knows? I mean, on and on. The end of chapter 8, no one can find out what is happening under the sun. They will not find it out. They cannot find it out. These are all that I have underlined. And you go on and on. And then it really reaches a crescendo in chapter 11. Chapter 11, 1 through 6. Four times in these short verses, you have this phrase, you do not know. You do not know, you do not know, you do not know. Pretty important theme in Ecclesiastes. Keeps us humble. You do not know. God is in heaven and you are on earth. Let me read this and make some comments. And these comments are intended to, I hope, evoke ideas for teaching and preaching this. I wanted to highlight that Carpe Diem passage because I think it's important. And I also wanted to highlight this text because it also is a very important theme in Ecclesiastes, you do not know. Send out your bread, verse 1, upon the waters, for after many days you will get it back. Divide your means seven ways, or even eight, for you do not know what disaster may happen on earth. Now, these are two proverbs, and it can go two ways in terms of interpreting. One way, I noticed that Chris took one way, and that is this is really kind of a commercial kind of image and metaphor about use of money and financial means, and that is a very possibility, a very real possibility. I take the other interpretation, which is actually scholars are really split on this, and I take the really the cop out on this, and I would say these are proverbs, and so they have multiple levels of meaning. Proverbs have multiple levels of meaning. I take the idea that these have to do with benevolent acts. It's a metaphor for benevolent acts. I think it fits the context a little better. I have problems there in verse 1. After many days, you will get it back. If this is an investment, I want more than just it back. But anyway, you can argue both ways. In a sermon, I probably would not bring that out. I'm just going to state what I think is my best interpretation of it and go with it. And I think it goes a little better with the whole context here. And so from there, he's talking about, he uses different metaphors for the uncertainties of weather and disasters. It seems pretty like a no-brainer, you know, kind of a duh. Verse 3, when clouds are full, and I'll come back to verses 1 and 2, I hope, here. When clouds are full, they empty the rain on the earth. Duh. Whether a tree falls to the south or to the north, in the place where the tree falls, there it will lie. Duh. What's being said here is that we don't have, as humans, any control over when it rains. And we don't have any control when the wind blows which way a tree is going to fall. It'll fall where it falls. I can't tell the tree to fall to the north. It's going to fall the direction it wants. There are things that are well beyond our control. And then he moves to the agrarian image. Whoever observes the wind will not sow. A watch pot never boils. And whoever regards clouds will not reap. This is an agrarian image of a farmer who's kind of pacing back and forth, trying to figure out, is he going to plant? Should I plant now? Should I wait? Should I plant now? Should I wait? Well, if you do that, then you aren't going to be very productive. The perfect time will never come. You just have to take some risks. And then the final analogy here, or metaphor, is in verse 6 as well. Just as you do not know how the breath comes to the bones in the mother's womb, so you do not know the work of God who makes everything. So just as there's mystery in the womb of how a child is formed, so is the mystery of God. Here's the distance of God again. I mean, we don't know as humans. We are limited. So, verse 6. And in a sermon like this, what I have done is I take the middle section here, verses 3 through 5, and I develop that. And I use verses 1 and 2 and verse 6 as kind of the climax of the sermon. Because I think that's where I want to go, and that's what I think this is all about. In the morning, verse 6, sow your seed, and at evening, do not let your hand be idle, for you do not know which will prosper, this or that, or whether both alike will be good. So in other words, in the morning, sow your seed, at evening, in other words, in the face of uncertainty, take risks. Take risks. We don't usually think of wisdom as involving risks, but wisdom does. Wisdom, true wisdom, is the ability or the willingness to take risks, to trust in the bigger picture of things. And so you take risks in the face of uncertainty. And I believe the whole point here is that we take risks with the way in which we are benevolent toward others. Our benevolence toward others. We offer spontaneous deeds of kindness. We don't know how they're going to turn out. We diversify our benevolent acts. We don't know about the outcome of those, but we know that that is what is best. To me, that's the bottom line of that in terms of you do not know this whole idea, this whole theme of. No one knows what will happen. We don't know. I mean, all the way through here, this is where this key virtue comes in. And I know my time is up here. This is where the key virtue of fear God comes in. What does fear God mean for Kohelet? It means that we completely surrender to Him, we trust Him, and we go forward. We trust Him. We don't know the outcome. We don't know what's ahead. Let me give you just a final example of this. This came to me yesterday. A man I was talking to who knows my dad from a long time ago. My dad is 89. My dad lives in our home right now. My dad has been blind for 55 years. I had a farm in northern Colorado. And this man reminded me of the story. I knew about it, but he said, I want to tell you one story about your dad that just sticks up in my mind. It's the best story that I remember about him. He said, he went outside, and my dad is totally blind. We're not talking about legally blind. We're talking about totally blind. He said, your dad went out to the barn, and there was a shingle that was loose. And so he got a ladder, put it up on the side of the barn, climbed up on the roof, and was repairing the shingle. Well, in the meantime, a ram came up the alley and butted over the ladder. So he stuck up on the roof of the barn. And so Dad goes to the other end of the barn, and he remembers that there is there's a pile of hay at the base. Mm. And so he takes this leap off of the barn into this pile of hay, and fortunately his memory was correct, and he got off the roof.
That was loose hay, right?
Yes, I'm glad you. No, it wasn't baled hay. It was loose hay. Thank you. Yeah, and this man yesterday, who I hadn't seen in many years, he said, you know, that was an act of faith on your dad's part. He took a risk, and that was an act of faith. And he said, that has stayed in my mind for, this was back in the 70s when my dad and him were elders together. He said, that stayed in my mind. That is taking a risk, but not wild risk. We're not talking about wild, reckless risk. We're talking about a risk that involves, that really is the fear of God, if you will, if I can now transfer this to a spiritual realm. It's a risk that we take because we fear God. Trust God. Surrender to God. All right, sorry. I didn't leave any time for comments or observations, but I appreciate your faithfulness to the very end of the lectureship. Thank you.